morning, which is Daisy Washington versus Ameritech. Mr. Goldman?
May it please the court, counsel. After 20 years of faithful service, Ms. Washington, who was a manager at the Dorchester facility for Ameritech, just wasn't able to take it anymore. She broke down physically and mentally. She was off on an approved short-term disability leave starting June 20th, 1997, and with a short break in September, she continued on that disability leave until February of 1998. During that time, Ameritech agreed that she would fit the definition of disability under Ameritech's disability plan. The question here is whether Ameritech's removal of Ms. Washington from disability leave in February of 1998 was arbitrary and capricious, and their subsequent denial of her appeal was arbitrary and capricious. And I want to make 5 points with regard to how their removal of her from the disability leave was arbitrary and capricious. First of all, they did find that she was disabled for that entire period of time, and without any kind of triggering effect, any kind of doctor's statement that she was no longer disabled, Ameritech unilaterally and suddenly decided in February of 1998 that she was not disabled.
Can I ask you a question about Dr. Nowak? There is evidence in the record indicating that the administrators of the plan for some time were trying to get Dr. Nowak to send relevant information, the records, to them, and she just didn't. She didn't until almost a month after the final deadline. When you finally look at her letter, it says things that are probably the kinds of things the administrators were looking for, but is it your position that a plan can't deny a claim because the doctor doesn't supply the records?
Your Honor, there are so many problems with Ms. Washington, and there were during this whole period of time.
But what was the concrete information in front of the administrators of the plan? Which is a sort of different question from what was wrong with your client.
Well, the administrators had the same information that they'd had all along. They had the record from Dr. Lewis. They had the records from Dr. Berg. They had the records from her therapist, Ms. Hazenbush. They had the records from Dr. Nowak. And this supplemental letter in May of 1998 from Dr. Nowak just reinforced everything that the plan already knew about Ms. Washington.
But let's stop, because they didn't have all the records from Dr. Nowak. They were asking Dr. Nowak, according to at least a computer-generated claim record, to give them more records in this time period leading up to the February action, and she didn't do it. Maybe your client has a very serious dispute with Dr. Nowak. I don't want to get into that, but why was the plan not within its rights to insist on this documentation?
I think that the plan was within their rights to insist on the documentation from Dr. Nowak. Again, that's just a small piece of the puzzle.
So your position has to be that everything else in front of them, even without Dr. Nowak, was enough. But wasn't the problem there that it didn't sufficiently tie the subjective complaints to some objective diagnosis or condition?
Well, Your Honor, that's what the plan said. That's what the plan said in their final appeal response in July of 1998. But in the deposition of one of the plan committee members, he admitted that they had all the objective evidence that they needed in order to make a decision in his deposition. That's another point, that here the plan had all the information that was necessary to make a decision that she was disabled between June of 97 and February of 98. And suddenly in February 98, they decided she's not disabled, and they insist on more information. But in the end result, they admit that they had all the information that they needed. The other thing is that, you know, here we're looking for the ultimate determination of whether Ms. Washington was disabled or not. And although, admittedly, this wasn't in front of the plan, it's the fact that she was awarded Social Security Administration benefits for the entire period from June of 97 to the present indicates that the plan was plainly wrong, that they just...
Well, what evidence is there that Social Security Administration was using the same test?
Well, the definition of disability under the statute, the Social Security Administration statute, is even broader than the definition of disability under the plan's own definition, because the Social Security Administration, or the Act, requires that an employee be unable to work at all. And Ameritech's definition is that she'd be unable to work in her position with an accommodation. And that brings up another point. Throughout this whole proceeding, Ameritech was going under the, making its decisions on the notion that Ms. Washington was a service representative, when in fact Ms. Washington had a much more advanced and more difficult job of being a manager in this service facility. She didn't, her job wasn't to sit on the phone and talk with customers. Her job was to manage all these people, do performance evaluations, monitor their conduct, and it was a much more high-stress position than the service representative position. That is a big part of the definition of a disability is to know what her position was. And they went through this whole process with not even taking into account what her correct position was.
Isn't there an affidavit in the record indicating that they did in fact know, even though they were typing the wrong things down on the pieces of paper?
You know, that may be, but the bottom line is that in the notation records that are part of the record and in the decision letter, they identify her as a service representative. You had brought up the letter from Dr. Nowak. That letter goes to the very heart of what her psychological issues were. And
but
that
it was
were
late, wasn't it? Didn't they say the last time is something that would have been sort of mid-April, and didn't it come in May 19th?
It did come in after the time that they asked for documents to be submitted, but it came in 2 months before they actually made their decision. They did have time to consider it. They could have considered it as an alternative application if they really wanted to.
But did they have to? I mean, was it arbitrary and capricious for them to stick to their deadline?
That issue in and of itself would not have been arbitrary and capricious. All these issues, taken as a whole, can't be mistaken for mere negligence or something less than an arbitrary and capricious. The definition of arbitrary and capricious under the Reich case is that it is completely unreasonable, and I see that my time is up.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Thompson.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Hubert Thompson. I represent the defendant, Appellee. Your Honor, in this case, the plaintiff seeks to overturn the plan administrator's determination terminating plaintiff's short-term disability benefit. As counsel has acknowledged, the standard for doing that is the arbitrary and capricious standard. It is our position, Your Honor, that there is no evidence in this record at all that supports a finding that the committee's actions were arbitrary and capricious. And I want to address the issue that counsel has raised to the court and the question, Your Honor, that you've raised, specifically with regard to Dr. Nowak's records. Those records, Your Honor, not only were late by a month, they're also not properly before this court. If the Dr. Nowak information was presented to the district court in response to the summary judgment motion of the plan, if you look at those records, Your Honor, they are simply dumped into the record in terms of the response, they're not supported by an affidavit, they're not supported by a deposition transcript, they're not supported by interrogatories or a statement sworn under perjury. They're simply in the dropped into the response of the plaintiff with no verification whatsoever.
You need, some sort of authentication? Or
absolutely. Mm-hmm. It is Hornbook law in this circuit and everywhere else that to oppose a motion for summary judgment, you must do so with records and documents that are authenticated by one of the means that are permitted under Rule 56. There is no such authentication of those documents, and they are simply not properly before this court at all, and were not properly before the district court. So in addition to the fact that the records were late, they cover a time period that is not the time period that was at issue before the committee, they're also simply not properly before this committee, excuse me, before this court, and were not properly before the committee.
Now you had another doctor's report, right?
Hazen Bush was a therapist. She was a clinical social worker who provided information, case notes with regard to the plaintiff's condition. She noted that the plaintiff's condition was improving. She noted things like the plaintiff was being able to cook more, she was being able to maintain her personal hygiene, that she was cleaning her house. She was preparing sermons on a monthly basis that she was preparing for delivery. She also gave her a GAP score, a global assessment score of 51, and that score is consistent with a moderate impairment, not a severe impairment. Those are the objective types of information that the committee was requesting and received and based its decision on. You're correct, Your Honor. The committee consistently and frequently requested information from Dr. Nowak, the psychiatrist, and that information simply was not forthcoming. And the committee, in its discretion, could determine that it could rely on the information that was before it in the absence of the documents or records from Dr. Nowak.
Was there any reason given? Was it certain that Dr. Nowak received the request, or was she citing some privilege, or what was the problem?
The problem was non-responsiveness, Your Honor, as far as the record reflects.
Silence.
There's a very loud silence out there. There was no response, and apparently, if the records are to be believed, at some point after the deadline, there may have been some information. That information is not properly before the court, Your Honor.
And the problem with all the other information is what? That it was, mental illness, of course, tends to have rather subjective descriptions.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so why, taking as a whole, not just Hazen Bush's account, but the others, wasn't there enough evidence to show that this woman was, in fact, sufficiently restricted because of her mental illness that she couldn't do the job, either with or without, in other words, whether the GAP score is 51 or 49 or 55, if it was bad enough that she couldn't do the job with or without accommodation, then didn't she fit the definition?
Well, that is exactly the burden that the plaintiff has of showing to this court. You ask the question of what is there in the record that reflects this disability in the absence of Dr. Nowak's information, and counsel referred to doctors, but not to the evidence. There is no evidence. And with regard to mental illness, there are indicators or indicia of functional capabilities, such as personal hygiene, for example. If you're able to get out of bed and get yourself cleaned up, these are kind of things that reflect on one's abilities, the mental capacity. And a score on a GAP, the global assessment of functioning, is a objective criteria that is universally recognized in the mental health field regarding the level of functioning ability of someone who is mentally impaired. So there certainly are, and it's also important to note that the Hazen Bush, this is not someone who was retained by Ameritech. This was the plaintiff's personal therapist that she had chosen and had been seeing over a period of time. And this is these were her notes with regard to her patients. So there's no suggestion that Ameritech was relying on some information from someone who had some interest other than the patient's own welfare. The information with the argument with regard to the Social Security Administration is simply, as you point out, Your Honor, not relevant because the standard of the Social Security Administration versus the standard of Ameritech is not the issue. The issue that this court has cited repeatedly is, did the Social Security Administration rely on the same records, files, and facts? Did it have the same things in front of it that the plan committee, that the plan administrator had in front of it? The evidence of record in this case is silent as to what the Social Security Administration had in front of it. The burden is on the plaintiff to show that the Social Security Administration had the same information in front of it as the plan administrators had in front of them. The plaintiff has not done that, and therefore, what the Social Security Administration concluded 9 months, 10 months after the plan administrators made their decision simply is not relevant to this determination. The other claim that the plaintiff makes in this court relates to the issue of Dr. Belinsky, who was one of the reviewing physicians, being biased. There simply is nothing in the record other than the argument of counsel to support that. Your opinion, the rulings of this court require actual showing of bias. There simply is none. The plaintiff would have this court simply assume if a physician has been retained by an employer, that physician will issue an opinion favorable to the employer. That doesn't make any sense logically, and it's certainly not consistent with the law of this circuit.
It would be very harsh for physicians who therefore have to render all of their services for free in these cases.
Well, I suspect the physicians are not rendering their opinions for free in this or any other case that I know of, Your Honor. I believe, Your Honor, with regard to the other point that counsel has made is that the committee found the plaintiff disabled up to a certain point and then without any triggering event stopped. That really is not the issue. The issue is not why did the committee pay disability benefits at a point in the past. The issue is, was the committee proper, did it act arbitrarily and capriciously in terminating the benefits at a given point? If the committee chose, out of an abundance of caution, to pay benefits up until a point until it had information and then ceased, the committee cannot be faulted for that. The question is simply, at the point at which the committee terminated benefits, was the decision arbitrary and capricious, or if it was not, then the committee's decision must be upheld. Counsel has stated the issue as whether or not the plaintiff has proven that she was disabled. That is not the decision for this court to make. This court's decision is simply, did the committee act arbitrarily and capriciously? Under that standard, this court has ruled that it is not for this court to second guess the underlying opinion. It is not for the court to even judge whether or not it would have relied upon the same authority. Simply, if the committee's decision is not completely unreasonable, this court will uphold that decision. And in this case, Your Honor, the plaintiff had the burden of showing that the committee's decision was arbitrary and capricious. There's no evidence in this record to support it, and we believe that the district court's granting of summary judgment should therefore be upheld. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Goldman? Minute and a half.
Your Honor, with regard to the notes from Ms. Hasenbush, it's our contention that the interpretation of those notes by the plan was taken out of context. Mentions of making sermons and reading to people in retirement homes, we maintain, were suggestions made by Dr. Hasenbush or therapist Hasenbush. The real issue is this GAF number, 51, is right on the cusp between moderate and serious impairment. And therefore, based on those kinds of things and the arguments that we made before, the decision of Ameritech's plan was arbitrary and capricious and should be overturned. Thank you.
Hey, thanks very much. The case will be taken under advisement.